This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Neta Yodovich about Women Negotiating Feminism and Science Fiction Fandom, The Case of the Good Fan. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is a great book. It was incredibly interesting. I sort of was reflecting on like my own position as kind of a sci-fi fan and my own sort of relationship to this genre, as well as actually learning quite a lot about things like contemporary fandom as an area of research, broadly, you know, kind of questions of gender, feminism, inclusion, exclusion. So lots of different kind of academic themes as well as the sort of fascinating core case study. And I guess the place to start with the book is probably a question about what it's actually about. And I guess for many listeners, we'll have a kind of a sense of what fandom is and what that means. But actually, you use it, I guess, in quite a kind of specific way in the book. So what actually is fandom? What are you actually writing about?
Yeah, well, it's a very challenging question, I think, because one of the main themes of the book is exclusion and inclusion and who gets to decide who's included or not. So defining fandom is automatically means that I will have to decide who is included in that concept and who is not. But if I have to try to still come up with a conceptualization of the term, I would say that it's first and foremost an emotional connection to a popular culture content or a celebrity or artist. And you just feel connected to them. You care about them. You care what they're doing, what they're up to, what they feel, what they experience. And second thing is it's also a cognitive connection. It's an intellectual connection. You want to know everything there is to know about that person, about that series, about the books. You want to analyze everything. And again, it's because you care. You love it so much that you feel like you always have to be involved with it in some way. The other two elements that are very important in fandom are the participation element, which is, again, because you want to be involved, because you want to do something with all of these emotions, you want to maybe create. So you write fan fiction, or you create fan art, fan videos, and the list goes on and on. And the last thing, which is something that is very prominent in my book, is the community element, is the social element. So you have all these emotions. You want sometimes to share them with other people. You want to be excited with other people who are also excited about the same thing. So you go and you search for like-minded individuals. And maybe then you also become a member of a community, whether it's online or offline. And these are pretty much the four main tenets of what fandom is. It's the emotion, it's the intellectual connection, it's the practice, and it's the community.
I mean, that element of community, the final point you make there, it is quite a nice way of getting into, I guess, why sci-fi in particular can be quite problematic. And one of the things that runs right the way through the book is the kind of idea that on the one hand, you've got a genre that is sort of open to anybody and everybody, but also on the other hand is really not open to anybody and everybody. And in particular, the book uses the case study of feminist women. And I wonder if you could sketch out, I guess, sort of, not what the problem of sci-fi is exactly, but why sci-fi is kind of both a good case study and where some of the tensions come for feminist women fans, which obviously is, you know, we're going to talk in detail about.
Yeah. So if it's okay, I will start with the feminism part, which is, so I was interested in fandom, of course, but I was also interested in how feminist women negotiate their fanish interests. And that's because I am a feminist fan. I've been a fan for many, many years now, and I started realizing as I got older, as I got wiser, hopefully, that some of my fandoms are problematic, or that's not even the fandoms, just some artists, directors that I appreciated their work, and I realized maybe I should stop watching their movies because of things that they've done. And it was a really difficult decision to make, to know that you love what they do, but you can't take part in that anymore. So I was interested in understanding how do other people solve this tension, mostly because I wanted to know how to solve the tensions that I experienced. And science fiction is a case, well, first and foremost, I would say that it tends to be the genre that is most explored in fan studies. Probably also because the people who are fan studies scholars, they are fans of science fiction. So it's also the first thing that you would go to. So that was also the first thing that came in my mind when I chose my case studies. And I think it is also one of the things that are studied the most, or one of the genres that is studied the most, is because science fiction and fantasy, they offer a different world, a world that could have completely different norms, different social structures, and of course, different understandings of gender and ethnicity and disability. And so there's so much hope, so much to gain from such a genre. But at the end, and especially with a very successful content or franchises like Star Wars and Doctor Who, which were the case studies that I chose, they tend to disappoint. Maybe not everyone, and I don't think that they're always doing a terrible job. Not at all. I think they're in a great gray area, where sometimes they do incredible things in terms of representation of women or people of color, but sometimes they do it quite badly. And then the people who do want to see this kind of diversity and do want to see or want to believe that the franchises that they are a fan of, that they are feminist, they tend to get a bit disappointed by them. And the last thing that I want to comment on is, of course, the community, which sci-fi, for I guess for different reasons, is considered a male-dominated fandom. And even though women were involved from the beginning, even with Star Wars, you would see women lining up to watch, you know, whatever movie that came out, just as much as men. And still, it was associated more with men and more with like boys or teenagers. So it's again that thing of also, what do you do when you want to be part of the community? You want to be regarded as a fan, but you're considered kind of second class because you're a woman, or if we're looking from an intersectional point of view, because you're a woman of color. So these are all the challenges that I wanted to unpack in this book.
Yeah, I see. The intersectionality is a really key point, and it comes up sort of several times in the book. And I wonder if we could sort of pause and think about it in the context of how your participants, these feminist women, fans of sci-fi, kind of get into sci-fi, but also how they have to manage things like their gender, their ethnicity, their age, when they're thinking about their relationship to the genre, and then their kind of almost their kind of status or their, you know, sort of legitimacy as fans.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think, well, first of all, I had incredible interviewees. All of them were so insightful, and they really, you know, shared with me all their experiences, and I'm very thankful to them. So yeah, it was very interesting in terms of how they got to become fans of science fiction, or specifically Doctor Who and Star Wars. So I will give a few examples of like the interesting things that I found. So there were those who became fans because their fathers were fans of science fiction or fantasy. And what was interesting about that is that they somehow, I don't know what the intention of the dads were, because I didn't interview them. But what my interviewees learned from their dads is that being a science fiction fan as a girl, it makes you cool. It makes you different from other girls. So at first it sounded very exciting to them. But when they kept thinking more about it, or when I analyzed what they were saying, it's basically that they learned that it's cool because it's not for girls. It's for boys. And you are more special than other girls because you're interested in something that is not for you. So that makes you different. That separates you from the girls who like the princesses and, you know, are dressed in pink. But it's kind of a double-edged sword in a way, because you understand that it's not made for you. So that was one thing. And another thing was with, I had some interviewees who are identified as Black women or mixed ethnicities. And they talked about how their families could not understand why they were fans of Star Trek or Star Wars or Doctor Who, because it seemed so white to them, and they didn't understand why they would find any interest in something that does not represent them at all. And I had one interviewee who said that her dad actually asked her they used VCRs, so to record Star Trek when it aired every week. But he kind of never talked to anybody about it. He never said that he liked Star Trek. Even though it's quite diverse, it's considered quite a diverse show, but he kept it a secret because it wasn't really appropriate to be a Black man who is interested in science fiction.
One of the things that comes through, I mean, you sort of flagged the, how can I phrase it, the kind of, yeah, the weirdness that kind of gets thrown at some of your fans for liking particular things. One of the things that comes through is that it's not just the kind of responsibility of the fans that were your participants in terms of, you know, how they relate to the genre and their fandom. Actually, they encounter quite a lot of kind of gatekeeping. So, you know, the shaping of something like Star Wars as a, you know, coded white phenomenon, or, you know, Star Trek being seen as maybe slightly more diverse, but, you know, maybe still not as kind of racially open as maybe it might otherwise be. It's not just the kind of a product of what's in these shows, but also it's a product of kind of gatekeeping practices. Predominantly actually by men in kind of sci-fi fandom communities. And I was really taken by this idea of conditional belonging that you tease out, I think, in the middle of the book. And I'm sort of keen to know more about that, but also keen to hear about how, I guess, the kind of, you know, the sense of belonging is not just something that comes from the feminist sci-fi fans themselves, but also they're sort of up against you know, some kind of barriers actually that are generated by what I, as the reader, kind of thought was sort of bad behavior from men.
Yeah. Conditional belonging is a concept that I'm quite happy came up with, kind of. It was used in the literature, at least in the literature that I found before, but somehow never actually explained. So I was happy to kind of try to do it myself. So the idea of conditional belonging is when a newcomer or someone who is perceived as a newcomer joins an established group, and they don't have access to a full access to everything that the group or the community can allow them to have. And in order to be fully included, they have to align, they have to conform with the norms, with the values of the group. They're not allowed to challenge anything. And if they do, they will just be rejected. And the idea of, or another important aspect of conditional belonging is that sometimes it's implicit. It's not like someone will tell you, no, you can't go to Comic-Con. You stay at home. Nobody will tell you that. But once you go to Comic-Con or, you know, to a local science fiction convention, you will implicitly get some different comments or looks or behaviors that will make you understand that you do not belong there, or you do not belong there as much as other people might. So that's the idea of conditional belonging. And in terms of, yeah, so it sometimes it's not really a matter of what the franchise offers, because as you said, as we both said, in Star Trek, they have a quite a diverse cast. In Star Wars, they in recent years introduced many characters from different ethnic backgrounds. And yet the community itself usually is quite defensive when that thing happens. And there are cases of severe backlash towards these characters. And what was interesting is that the women that I interviewed, they said that they take it personally when someone attacks, for instance, the character of Rose in Star Wars, because they say, she's me. That character is me. That actress is me. She is a woman from an Asian background or from any other marginalized ethnicity background, and she wants to be included. She is so passionate about Star Wars, but they just don't want to have her. And I relate to that. I feel that way. So this is one of many, many cases where the women that I interviewed understood that they can maybe be there in the community, but they're not supposed to talk about certain things. Again, if it's offline or online, I had women who said that in certain online communities, they will not say that they are women. They will not obviously say that they are feminists. They will not talk about certain things or raise different kinds of critiques in certain communities because they know that they will get a huge backlash. So they just don't. And that's, again, one of those mechanisms that nobody really talks about, but everybody's aware that it happens. So it ends up into a mechanism of self-policing, where the women themselves end up just not saying anything just from being afraid that they will be attacked.
You mentioned Rose, and Rose is a kind of fascinating character in lots of different ways. And towards the end of the book, you sort of juxtapose Rose with Leia from Star Wars. So, I mean, I sort of assume people know who these characters are, but I guess, you know, Rose comes into Star Wars comparatively late in the 8th and 9th films. Obviously, Princess Leia is sort of, you know, in the original trilogy, and obviously is important in the later sequels as well, and is maybe a bit kind of better known. And it was interesting that your research tried to go beyond just, I guess, kind of how do feminist women describe themselves as science fiction fans, but also to think about how they interpret and kind of deal with the representations of particular iconic characters in the genre they love. And earlier you mentioned, you know, some of the things you yourself as a fan like, but maybe find problematic because of the director or problematic because of particular representations. And it was really interesting to see how your participants responded to characters like Leia, who has been presented in ways that are kind of incredibly strong and positive, and then in ways that are highly problematic. And similarly, you know, with Rose, who on the one hand was presented in, you know, a really kind of positive and strong role, and then later on is kind of completely marginalized and almost ignored. So what was the kind of interpretation, and how did your participants kind of navigate some of these, I suppose, quite ambivalent elements of these characters?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. I think that that was a really interesting way to talk about feminism, because obviously not all feminists think alike. What one might find empowering, the other will find concerning. And this is another kind of friction that I'm interested in. So what is like the proper way to be a feminist, or is there such a thing, or who is a feminist icon, and can she be always like perfect, always feminist, always like on point, or are there moments of friction? So I'll start with Leia. Obviously, yeah, Leia is a huge, first of all, icon. I'm sure that even the people who've never seen Star Wars, they know her face, they know her white gown, robe, and they also know the sex slave Leia outfit. And these are two interesting representations of the same character. So obviously with the you know, the gun fight, the gun shooting Leia, the witty snarky Leia, everybody loves that version. But then it gets more tricky when it gets to the sex slave Leia, where I really had two different approaches with the feminists that I interviewed, where some found it very empowering, and they found it. I'll explain that there is a scene in Return of the Jedi that when Leia is captured by Jabba the Hutt, and he shackles her with chains, and he grabs the chains whenever he's annoyed and kind of brings her closer to his body. And the clothes that she's wearing are very revealing. It's basically a bikini, a gold bikini. And at a certain point, Leia used the chains that he used in order to capture her, to keep her captivated, and she strangles him, she kills him. So for some feminists, they found it a beautiful depiction of a woman bringing down, you know, the patriarchy with its own chains, basically. And they found it very, very empowering. But there were the ones who said, who talked about the issue of consent, and they said that it would have been nice if she chose the character to be dressed this way and to be a sex slave, basically. But she didn't, and she was captured. And therefore, there's nothing empowering about being like dressed this way. And they also mentioned the fact that the actress, Carrie Fisher, that she was very uncomfortable being in those scenes, that she had to have a strict diet in order to, you know, dress that, wear that bikini. And so it goes even beyond what you see on screen. So if you think about what the actress had to go through and how she will forever be known for that bikini, they found it quite upsetting. Another version of Leia that I want to mention before moving on to Rose is General Organa at the end of Leia's kind of plot line, which had to end up quite abruptly, sadly, because of Carrie Fisher's passing. But that was also an interesting case, because I didn't mention, but age was another thing, another identity, I could say, that I looked into in this study. And I saw how the older interviewees that I had women who were like 50-year-olds, and they were quite upset with the way that the media talked about Carrie Fisher when she reprised her role later in life, and how people kept asking, oh, is she still good looking or is she not? Oh, she looks old for her age, and compare, and nobody did that with the other actors who also reprised their roles. They only did it to her. So it was, and it was interesting that it was the older interviewees who really paid attention to that. And again, they really identified with that, and they felt quite, again, concerned, and again, as a sign that they're not included in this community anymore, because they are also not young and as attractive as they were when they were younger. So that is the case of Leia. And with Rose, it was, to put it simply, it was a huge mess. It ended up being a huge mess because the fandom, when I say the fandom, it's not everyone, of course, but there were very loud voices in the fandom who were quite angry at her character, didn't want her to be included. And they, again, it wasn't just the character. They also attacked the actress, who had to basically shut down all her social media platforms or accounts. So this was yet another example for my interviewees to understand that they're not, that they're not included. And I will mention that because of the backlash in the last movie, Rose barely had any spoken words coming out of her mouth. Like, she was basically just, just someone in the background, didn't have any kind of speaking role, basically. So the women that I interviewed saw it as a sign. See, like, they are so scared of all those angry fans that they were able to do this to Rose. They didn't listen to us, who really liked Rose. They listened to them. So this is yet another example that we are kind of second-class citizens in this fandom.
Those two characters and the sets of reactions, I guess, are quite nice examples of some of the kind of tactics that feminist women fans use, both, you know, to kind of reclaim ownership of perhaps problematic representations, and to say, actually, you know, there are things that studios or writers have decided on that we really disagree with and we want to change. And also at the same time, you know, kind of push back against backlash and, you know, sort of challenge the idea that they only have conditional belonging to sci-fi fandom. And I think this is a really important sort of element of the kind of conclusions that the book comes to, you know, the kind of the agency that both your participants, but feminist women fans more generally have in terms of kind of changing sci-fi as a genre and changing what sci-fi fandom means as well. And I wonder if you could give some examples of those kind of tactics.
Yes. One of the chapters in the book is, well, after I go quite on and on about all the problems and all the challenges and all the frictions, I then introduce the tactics that my interviewees used in order to try to reconcile the tensions that they feel. So I had two umbrella terms for the tactics. One was narrative tactics and one was practice tactics. So with the narrative tactics, it included the kinds of rationale that they come up with in order to organize their identities, their thoughts, their values, to themselves, and also if they have to ever explain it to someone else. So these included, for instance, that long word that I hope I will be able to pronounce without getting my tongue tied, compartmentalization, which is basically, they would say, okay, I notice the problems. It's not like I didn't notice them, but I choose not to pay attention to that and pay attention to the things that still make me happy and things that I still love about the franchise, whatever it might be. And so that was one thing. And the other thing was also, I called it imperfect feminism. So basically what they would say, so again, it's that them identifying with their fandom. So they would say, I'm not a perfect feminist. I sometimes get things wrong. I still need to grow and learn and become a better feminist. And so does my favorite franchise. So I see that they're trying. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But we're both learning and growing. So that was another thing that they came up with. And with the practice tactics, so it included different fanish practices that are quite well known in fan studies. So again, they might go and write fan fiction where they would fix problems. They would fix plot lines that they didn't like. They would fix characters that they thought were misrepresented. And that would be one way to kind of gain more ownership and envision the fandom or the franchise that they want to see. In other cases, so in terms of consumption, they would make sure to only buy, let's say, the female characters, whatever kind of merchandise that was related to them in terms of like Star Wars. There was a big campaign when Rey was first introduced, which was hashtag Where's Rey, because she was the star and yet none of the merchandise featured her, at least in the beginning. So they would make sure to buy whatever Rey merchandise they found. And also they emphasized that they also do it, those who are mothers did it for their children. So they would play, they would be familiar, or they would practice playing also with female figurines. So if they had boys, they won't only buy them the Luke Skywalkers, they would buy them the Reys, the Princess Leias. So they would, they would also be interested in female characters and not just in the male characters. They also talked about, and I'll mention it because I think it's quite important. They also mentioned finding alternative communities, which is a big question on its own, but I had women who said, look, I'm tired. I don't want to, I don't think that the burden of bringing a change to the community should rely on me. It should rely on those who are in power, let's say. Should rely on those who have more agency, more control over the fandom. They are the ones who should actually bring the change. I am tired of this. I'm finding an alternative, more safe community where I'm not the minority anymore, where I'm the majority, or I'm with my equals. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to try to be accepted to a community that doesn't want me. So that was another thing.
The book ends with this, I think, really brilliant question, which is, what can we learn from the case of feminist women fans? And from what you were saying there in terms of the narrative and kind of practice tactics, I mean, that's one really obvious thing, isn't it, in terms of what individuals and communities can do across a range of different, not just fandom or genre examples, but actually across a whole range of different kind of social settings. But I guess there are kind of other elements that the book teases out. And I suppose, the kind of the way to conclude is to repeat that question, really. What can we learn from this case study? What do you think are the sort of broader insights that go beyond just this example?
Yeah, I think I'll explain why also it's there, why I put that in the book. Even before I answer the question, and that's because I'm a sociologist. That's the department that I'm in, the departments I've always been part of. And sometimes it seems like people, and it's not just for sociologists. I think it's for many people who study fans. It feels like it's, why are you studying this when there are way more urgent things to study in the world, like much more important, much more, you know, related to policy and to all sorts of things. So why are you wasting your time? And so I always felt like I had to defend not just my research, but, you know, the field as much as I could. And I think that actually there's so much to learn from fans, because it's an identity that people are so passionate about. And I hope I said it a few times, so I hope it's it comes you know, it's clear enough. But yeah, people are so passionate about it, and it is like a microcosmos of the bigger society, especially because there are so many different frictions and conflicts that are related to really important topics. So again, like racism and sexism, ableism, ageism, and because people are so passionate about it, they speak about it so so openly and explicitly. And so I think it's a great opportunity to learn about people you exclude or include or gatekeep, and these kind of, so with conditional belonging, I think it's something that could be used in many different research and studies. So it could be, and again, the case in general could be related to issues of women who work in a masculine profession, or religious people trying to, you know, negotiate things that are, you know, their affinity to things that are more not, that are not really religious. So I think there's a lot of things that people can take from the book and from its findings and implement it to their research, where it's, you know, could be something completely different than fan studies. But fan studies matters. It really does. There's so much to learn. So that's why I put it in the book. And it's one of the things that kind of conclude the book. And hopefully it comes across in the book.
You set out, I guess, what could be a really broad agenda moving from the book there in terms of your own work, you know, examples of how you might apply things beyond fan studies. But also one of the things that I got from the book was a sense of actually there's lots more kind of interesting questions, comparative work, you know, lots of things about different genres that could come from the book. There's, you know, kind of further contributions to fan studies. So where do you go kind of next? What are you sort of, you know, thinking of in terms of next projects or possibly even next books?
Oh, that's a very good question. Something that I'm really interested in is going beyond the individual, and I'll explain. Many of my interviewees talked about their boyfriends or husbands, partners, and again, that kind of the way that their boyfriends or husbands are treated when they go, for instance, to like a gaming store, in comparison to how they are treated. So I would love to study more the dynamic between couples, especially couples who are interested in similar popular culture content, and the way that they shape each other and their different experiences with the fandom or just with consuming whatever it might be. So that is something that I hope I will get to do in the future, hopefully.